people will actually also, I don't know what he's going to talk about, but I presume it would be kind.
True. Okay. So let me just start with explaining the title. I don't know if this device is going to work yet. Okay. So, well, historically, apology is the is associated with the name of Socrates, who actually was trialed in 5th century BC in Athens and was actually found guilty and sentenced to death for corrupting the minds. And as a matter of fact, there were three accusers during this trial. And likewise, I think that if you if you talk to people about doubly special relativity that I'm going to tell you more about in a moment, at least about definition, there are essentially three kind of accusations against this kind of framework. Well, the first accusation is that this, the doubly special relativity is nonsense because you shouldn't play with Lorentz symmetry. Lorentz symmetry sucked, which means that you shouldn't really do anything about it. I mean, it's something that's the basic symmetry of nature, and you shouldn't try to deform it in or break it in any way. Another accusation, which is kind of recent accusation, is that this framework is phenomenologically not acceptable. Actually, it leads to to effects that we can rule out by simple observation. And the second accusation, which I think is the most serious, is that there are conceptual problems with this framework. I mean that this framework leads to conceptual problems that cannot be solved. So let me try to really tell you what the status is, and then I will go, at the end of my talk, I will go to some conclusions and my personal view about these accusations. So let me start with definition. What is DSR? Well, it's called doubly special relativity. It was called doubly special relativity, and some people use the name deformed special relativity. And there are so many particular examples that people actually try to investigate or to understand, that it's very hard to say what DSR is. So let me stick to one particular set of postulates, and then we'll see how far we can get from there. Okay? So the first postulate is that is the relativity principle. Okay? It means that essentially there are inertial frames and are completely equivalent with respect to physics. The second is the postulate that there are two, contrary to what we know from special relativity, where there is only one observer independent scale associated with the speed of light. While here we assume that there is a second observer independent scale of dimensional mass or length, which is identified with Planck mass, or at least identified with the scale of quantum gravity, or identified, for that matter, with the scale provided by Newton's constant. And there is a third postulate, which is a postulate about transformations. And, well, this is important because if you have the second observer independent scale, essentially the scale should be present in the transformation because all the observers might agree about the presence of the scale. In special relativity, for example, the speed of light is present in the transformation. If you do the boost, then the scale of velocity is present in the definition of the boost. And here, this scale should be somehow present in the way that transformation actually when two observers try to compare what they see, this scale should be present. Okay? Well, it's not the only possibility, but this is the simplest possibility, and this is the original way that the theory was formulated. to the first. Okay? Sorry?
Special relativity, you assume you know what relative velocity between two inertial frames is.
So, well, I'm not saying anything, I mean, that they are quite vague. These postulates are very vague. And they are very vague for purpose, and they were very vague in the original formulation, also for purpose. But essentially, there should be some relativity of inertial motion. Okay, so now some comments. These postulates are, as I said already, these postulates are quite vague, but it's not easy to satisfy them. The second thing which I want to stress, and I used to stress for years, is that this postulate should describe a fundamental theory, not a phenomenological test theory model. So what we are really interested in is the fundamental theory of the kinematics, because special relativity is about kinematics, and this is something which is to replace the special relativity in some particular circumstances. And if this theory is fundamental, okay, it should be derived from something more fundamental background theory. For example, and the hope is that this can be derived from this particular case of gravity or quantum gravity. And this is something I'm going to tell you more about later on. And now, the real challenge is, of course, to find a consistent example of a theory of this sort, which could be consistent mathematically and physically, and which could be confronted with experimentally. Well, we may have millions or zillions of self-consistent theories which are not the theories of nature. So eventually we'd like to actually confront the theory with experiment, but first of all, we need to make a theory to define the constructive theory which really makes some predictions that can be confronted with experiment. And to finish this introduction, it seems that except for 3D, and I will also tell you a little bit more about it later on, except in 3D, such theory has not been found yet.
So my view is that we haven't been successful in finding such a theory in physical for them. Yes. It's 2+1, yeah. Yeah, 2+1 or Euclidean, it doesn't matter. I mean, what I'm claiming, so let me actually explain what I mean here. I mean that the only example that we know of the theory of this sort, which by construction, we know that by construction is self-consistent and physically sensible, is the 2+1 gravity coupled to point particles. All right, so let me first actually tell you what can you do naively. Okay, so the first naive try, which is something that people tried at the very beginning of the history of DSR, was essentially to do something of the following, I mean, to do the following trick. Suppose that instead of the standard momenta of special relativity, in fact, the real physical momenta are not these ones, but some other ones, which are just functions of this special relativistic momenta and this parameter and this scale kappa. Okay? In such a way that the standard dispersionation, okay, is actually replaced with something more complicated, something of this word. I stress this is what the capital P are the real momenta. Okay? And of course, in the limit of low energies, when the energies are very small compared to the scale, to its mass scale kappa, there is no difference. Okay, so in the limit in which kappa goes to infinity, this guy goes to this guy. All right? Now, the question which is actually quite, well, the first question you should, people ask themselves was if it's just a change of variable, so is it an innocent change of variable, or is it actually something in equivalent. Okay, so if if we do this, are we just getting the same theory, just using some fancy variables, or is it we constructing a new theory? And the answer to this is that it depends. It really depends what you're doing. Well, of course, you can change variables. There is no problem with this. But then, so you can construct your theory. You can start with a special relativistic theory, and then you change variables, and of course, you get the same theory, just expressing different variables. On the other hand, it's not completely clear if I start a theory from scratch, which has a limit, whose limit will be special relativity, is it expressed in these new variables? Is it going to be a new theory, or is it going to be exactly the same old special relativity? And essentially, the problem, if you think about it, the problem is you cannot really resolve this problem fully in the case of one particle. You need to really know or define the way that many particle systems behave. So, for example, you need to know how the momenta act, what is the momentum conservation, or what does it mean, the minus momentum. And I'm stressing this because it is directly related to the theory of Hopf algebras, which I'm going to discuss briefly in later on. Okay? So we really need to specify in this fancy mathematical language, we really need to not only to change variables, but then we need to specify how you combine these variables together. What does it mean, multi-particle system? Okay, so let me give you an example. And also, I think if you start thinking about it, so if you start thinking about the problem if these two theories are actually equivalent, you see that it depends on particular model. I mean, just saying that you change variables doesn't really give you anything. You need to think in terms of particular models because some models might be equivalent and some other models might be not. Okay, so let me show you two different models. And actually, I will discuss only particle models in this lecture. I will not go to field theory. So let's see, I have two models. One is just a relativistic particle model expressed in standard variables. So this is momentum, this is first order formulas. So momentum and positions are independent variables. This is the kinetic term. This is the Hamiltonian constraint or the mass shell constraint, if it doesn't matter. This is the Lagrange lambda, is the Lagrange multiplier that enforces this constraint. This is just a standard first order formulation of relativistic particle. So if I change the variable, so if I express the same Lagrangian with the help of, in terms of this kind of new variables, replace the Hamiltonian constraint, then clearly this theory and this theory are different theories. For example, these guys transform in a completely different way because the transformation, okay, the Lorentz transformation must leave this invariant, which means that if C is non-trivial, then P must, the capital P must transform in a non-trivial way. And then it means that the capital X transforms in a non-trivial way. So if you actually naively say that these are the new positions, this is something that corresponds to space-time measurements, then you can easily see that this theory and this theory are completely different. Okay? They actually describe completely different physics. For example, the conserved momentum here is sum of small p's, and the conserved momentum here is the sum of capital p's. Right? There are different theories. Now, of course, also, just a simple calculation leads to the conclusion that the speed of light in this theory is actually energy dependent. Okay, the speed of light is essentially defined as x dot I over x dot zero. I will go to this at some point where the masses of the particles are zero. You can do this calculation. You find it immediately that it actually that speed of light is energy dependent. This is very naive, but many people were actually trying this kind of theories. Also, let me stress one more thing here, that the Lagrangian of multiparticle system, this kinetic terms, or, well, as a matter of fact, the whole of the Lagrangian, is essentially a sum of one particle of Lagrangians. Okay, this is a non-trivial statement. It actually tells you also that the conserved momentum is just a sum of this of these guys. Do you have a question?
Co-products are how you combine momenta for.
For both guys, the co-product is trivial. So the combination.
Just in physics language means that if you have a system with parts, you add the momenta of the parts to get the momenta of the whole.
We can discuss it later if you. All right, just a moment. We can discuss it later, but. It's kind of tricky because if you start changing updates, so if you start with this Lagrangian and just change variables, we end up with non-trivial co-product. All right?
Why do you say that the conserved momentum is the sum? This just looks like a bunch of free particles, so.
Because each momentum is essentially a sum of momentum of all the particles.
I mean, each momentum separately is conserved, right?
So each momentum separately is conserved, but the total momentum.
It seems to me that that statement only acquires a meaning when you introduce some sort of interactions among the particles, even if they're just point collisions or something. That's not really here yet.
The meaning of the statement will be clear later on, okay? And of course, you're right, that on the question, I mean, on shell, the momenta are conserved, right? The meaning of what I mean by total momentum is that if I think of net charge associated with translation, then the net charge associated with translation will be just the sum of these things. Okay? This is what I mean.
That answers the question, but it wasn't obvious to me how the net charge is the sum, because does that in fact work out? Because you've changed the Poisson brackets somehow.
No, I'm a... I'm sorry. So let me go back.
Have you changed them?
I'm thinking in very naive terms, okay? If I have this Lagrangian, then I can find what is the net of charge associated with rigid translation. Delta X is equal A. Okay, and this net charge is just the sum of parts, right? There's just nothing fancy here. I mean, this is completely, completely, completely basic mechanics.
But this is not just a change of variables, you see.
It is not a change of variables because if you assume that this Lagrangian as you want, if you assume that the Lagrangian is Lorentz invariant, then these guys would transform under Lorentz transformation completely different way than these guys. This will not be the Lorentz transformations of these guys would be the momentum dependent.
But the Poisson bracket of capital P and capital X
is just standard.
Just standard.
Of course. Plectic structure here is just standard.
I made a mistake when I thought the Poisson bracket stays the same. It's the same.
But I will go to example in which it's not going to be the same.
Just a simple question. What is the lambda?
What is lambda?
Lambda
is the Lagrange multiplier. Because you want this particle, we want the particle to be on shell, this is a Lagrange multiplier that enforces the on shell condition. Okay, now let me go to my movie, finally, which is a nice movie. Let me spend a moment talking about phenomenology. There was some excitement about the possible finding that the photons of different energies actually move with different speed. Essentially, this movie shows it. So we have the photons emitted with a distance source, and the photons of lower energy actually moves faster than the photons of high energy. And there is a little graph taken from the paper by Ellis, Mavromatos, and Anopoulos, in which they feed some data. They have actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points. They feed the data to a straight line, so that there is a clear, if you believe this, there is a clear relation between the distance from the source, on this here you have a distance from the source, and this is essentially the time difference between arrival of photons of different energies. But this is misleading, because you need a lot of data points. I mean, when you have this 5 data points, I can actually draw this line and it will be.
Well, the most important thing is that the only two points of the thing are reliable. One is the upper bound from Fermi, which is an upper bound, and the other is the 905.10, which is way off the alleged straight line.
Yeah. All right. So anyway. The initial hope, or one of the reasons why people were actually contemplating this kind of theories with energy-dependent speed of light, was that perhaps you can really observe it. And, of course, actually this is nice, because we will be able to see it. When we have a day, Fermi is there, it's collecting data, and doing more and more points here. And, eventually, after a couple of years, I think we will be completely sure if there is any kind of a relation between the distance of the source and time lag for arrival of photons of different energies. I think, well, I don't know, but perhaps Giovanni will tell more about it next week.
I have a short question about this kind of plot. So I never understood how you tell the difference between the fact that the photons are lazier and move slower on the trajectory, or they are emitted at different times.
Essentially, I don't really know much about the way the Fermi actually makes measurements. But essentially, I think that what they see is that the photons of different energies actually arriving at different times. And essentially, they see a correlation between arrival time and the energy of photon, right?
You can draw a straight line through any data. What among the mistakes in this plot, to my understanding, are to use what should be regarded as detections of limits as measurements. So if there is a photon which is more energetic, which is later, that sets a limit as to how much it might be further delayed, okay? But it might just be later because, as you said, it was emitted later.
Okay, so these are upper limits, actually.
Everything that, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't trust this anyway. But if you have a specific question, I think Giovanni, who is going to be here starting Monday, is going to tell you everything about it. So this is just as an amusement. Let me also turn to another phenomenological effect that people expect to be that it can be seen is essentially that if you have this kind of a framework, you expect that perhaps somehow the energy momentum conservation law will change, and then then this will actually result in slight deviation from relativistic kinematics prediction for ultra-high energy cosmic rays. And essentially the idea is that if you have a very high energy photon traveling from very distant source, then it can scatter the infrared background, which is not cosmic big infrared background, but the infrared background due to the infrared radiation of stars, producing the pion. And then it loses energy. And then you can calculate, knowing some astrophysical data, that for proton of energy which is higher than 10 to 20 EEV, EEV not GEV, EEV it's 10 to 10, it's 10 to 9 GEV, 10 to 11 GEV, then the free pass is for the 150 megaparsecs, which means that if you see the photon coming from the source, which is at the cosmological distance, you start doubting if, well, because this result uses the standard relativistic special relativity,
then you, so if you see this protons coming from cosmological distance, you would think that perhaps something that it manifests a deviation from standard special relativistic kinematics. However, none of such protons had been seen. Although the situation is not completely settled as far as I understand. But there are, at this moment, all the protons, we indeed see such protons, but it seems that we can localize sources within this radius. Okay? So this is a short comment about phenomenology, and the conclusion is that there are we don't see any phenomenology of this kind yet, at least. Okay. So now let me return to the major topic, namely to trying to derive doubly special relativity from some fundamental theory, which will be the theory of gravity. Essentially, the reason is the following. Well, we are interested in the kinematics of particles in flat spacetime, but flat spacetime is some spacetime. It's a particular configuration of gravitational field. And then the question is, so if I really switch on the full gravity and then take a flat space limit, is gravity completely, or influence of gravity is completely lost, or is it something, some trace of gravity left? And the idea is actually quite similar in the spirit to what we know from 2 plus 1 gravity, where there are no local degrees of gravity, and the space-time is, well, locally flat, or if there is a cosmological constant, it's locally anti-de Sitter or de Sitter. But still, if you start thinking about the way the effective kinematics of particles, you see that this kinematics is deformed in a very particular way. Okay, so now let's try to see if it is possible to argue that similar thing may happen in 3 plus 1 gravity. Okay, the argument is not completely solid proof, I mean, waterproof, but I think there are some loopholes in this argument, but I think that the gaps can be filled. So let me just present it as it stands. Well, the first thing is that I need a formulation of gravity theory in which I can really get, in a natural way, I can get the limit in which local gravitational degrees of freedom actually switched off. And actually, due to some effort of Lee and Lorau and Artem Starodubtsev, we know this for such a formulation. It's actually essentially a mixture, the idea is a mixture of the Plebinsky, of the idea of Plebinsky and the ideas of McDowell and Mansouri. And the action for gravity contains three terms, of which two first terms express in terms of two form B and the curvature of connection of the Sitter group. Okay, this is the curvature, this is just a two form field, this is another term which you can construct from two field pole field, and these two yellow terms actually correspond to topological field theory, so there are no local degrees of freedom here. But then there is another term you can construct if you want to break the Sitter group down to Lorentz group. And this is this epsilon symbol which has this one index actually explicitly fixed. And I fix this index, this epsilon symbol actually is a four index epsilon symbol, which is, as you can see, easily is just an invariant element of the Lorentz group. So this term breaks explicitly the Sitter group down to the Lorentz group. One important thing is that then you decompose actually the connection, the original, the Sitter connection, you decompose into a translational part, which is here, and which is associated with tetrap. Now, you need to introduce a length scale here, And as you will see in a moment, this length scale is associated with cosmological constant, just for dimensional reasons. And then the Lorentz part of connection is just a Lorentz connection. And now, if you actually look at this action, try solve it for B and find equation of motions, you will see that it actually leads to Einstein equations. More generally, if you actually you keep alpha not equal to zero, so you break this, and if you actually do the Hamiltonian analysis of this action, you will find that this is exactly the Hamiltonian analysis of gravity theory in Holst formulation. So in fact, one can easily see that this beta parameter is related to the Mirzi parameter of gravity theory. Okay, to be more specific, the action, okay, this action that I started with is equal to just a gravity action with topological invariance, and then, okay, the gravity action contain is just a standard term, and this Einstein-Hilbert term, this is a cosmological constant term, and this is the so-called Holst term, and this term is actually completely innocent in classical theory because it doesn't contribute to equational motion, although it is not a topological invariant. Essentially, it vanishes when torsion vanishes. Okay, so if torsion is zero, this term is zero by Bianchi identity. And here is the relation between the coupling constant of gravity theory and these parameters alpha and beta and the scale L. Okay? And here, gamma is just the inertia parameter. Good. Now, yes.
Second form,
which
on the screen now.
Right.
Is it correct that any reference to the de Sitter group has disappeared?
Well, not yet. No, not really. Because there is a cosmological. Well, okay, we have a cosmological term. Okay, so in the sense, the vacuum solution, the Bagman solution, has de Sitter symmetry. Okay?
Well, that would be true if you just write down the standard Einstein theory with a cosmological constant, too. So I'm just wondering why you started with a connection and
the algebra.
That's what I thought you said.
I don't quite understand. I started with a theory. Okay, so for my purposes, the point is that this theory is actually a sum of a topological theory with no local degrees of freedom and some gauge breaking term, which is here, and yet it is completely equivalent to this. Classically, it is a completely equivalent to general relativity. Because what I'm going to do in a moment is to disregard this term, okay? So take alpha equal to zero, and then my point will be that if I take a limit of alpha going to zero of this theory, what I'm getting is a theory of, well, if I will couple to particles in a moment, it is the theory of the kind I'm looking for, because this will be a theory which in the limit in which cosmological constant goes to zero would describe just the locally Minkowski space. Okay? So this is what I want to achieve. This theory makes it possible for me to easily get the limit, easily switch our gravitational degrees of freedom. Local gravitational degrees of freedom. Because local gravitational degrees of freedom are essentially governed by the non-zero value of alpha. If alpha is zero, the gravitational degrees of freedom are present. But if alpha is zero, they are not.
Okay, well, my question wasn't that important. I was just curious. Is it true that f is a curvature of a connection which is valued in the Lie group of the de Sitter group? Mm-hmm. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
But in the second form, we don't see that. So,
well,
we do, in a sense.
Because if you look at this curvature, it contains again the component which is the which will be the Lorentz component, okay? Which will be just a
which will be just the theta curvature, the theta curvature in the sense that it will be r plus lambda ee, okay? And there is translational component along the while, I mean, when one index here is 4, which will be just torsion. Okay? So in a sense, a trace of this, this group is still present there. Although when torsion is 0, it falls down completely down to the standard case, except that here this holster appears by construction, not it doesn't need to be put by hand. And also, okay, like in the case of Mandola-Mansouri theory, there is of course a number of topological invariants here, right? Which is Euler, Pontryagin, and Mie-Yang classes. All right? Yes.
So, alpha goes to zero, j goes to L squared.
Where alpha goes to zero, sorry?
Alpha is going to zero, gamma blows up.
That's true.
And you?
Gamma is beta over alpha.
That's true. Yeah, but, okay. So, this is a subtle point. Well, if you start thinking about, you know, about taking the limit in this formulation, then of course, things go, G blows up too, in a sense, right? But I'm not taking the limit in this formulation. This formulation is obtained from the other formulation, which is a kind of master formulation. And then I can, in order to make this decoupling constant right, I need to make these associations. But I can take the limit in the master theory and then consider what was going to happen. And this is also understandable because if you think about the standard formulation of gravity, it's very hard to make a limit in which the you switch in cooperation with degrees of freedom. Lee was actually right. I think Lee wrote once a paper about this, and I don't know if it was completely successful, but it's not easy, right? In the standard formulation, switching of local degrees of freedom of gravity is not easy. Okay, so let me actually speed up. How much time do I have?
Another like 20 minutes, half an hour.
All right, okay, so let me speed up a little bit. So I'm not going to dwell on this very much. You can couple this theory to particles in a kind of a very natural way. And essentially, what I have to stress here is that essentially the particle, the kinematics of particle is actually encoded in the group element. Okay, so let me try to explain why it is so. And think about the Lorentz group, okay? And suppose I have a particle at rest, okay? If I make a Lorentz, so I have an observer, the particle is at rest. Suppose I make a Lorentz boost, then the particle moves, right? There is the one-to-one correspondence between the Lorentz transformation and the momentum of a particle, essentially, okay? And similarly, you can think of the translation, the rest of the generator, this translation generator of the distributed group. Essentially, what I want to stress here is that you can actually formulate the theory of particle coupled to gravity in a nice way, in which actually the whole kinematics of particle is actually encoded in the group element of the gauge group. Okay? This is something which is going to be quite important later on. And then, so you formulate, you take this action. This is the action that actually has been around for many years. I mean, there was first, I think, that the first, it was actually written down by Balachandran and Stern and some other people in late 70s, but not in this particular formulation. Anyway, what you can check that if you do that and you try the equation of motion for the particle, this particles actually move in a correct way. I mean, the equation of motion happens to be the Matheson-Papapetro equation if the particle has a spin on the background space-time where the torsion well, with possible torsion. And also you can check that Einstein equations also have the correct form in the sense that the spin of the particle is a source of torsion and the energy momentum of the particle is a source of curvature. Now, so let me go to the most important part of the lecture of what I want to say. Let's take this limit, okay? Which means that in this limit, the local degrees of freedom of gravity are switched off. You can look at the equation of motion, you see that actually, I start with this master theory, I take this limit, and if I look at the equation of motion, I find that there are indeed no local degrees of freedom for gravity. Then, what can be also shown is that if you look at the partition function, for example, this is the way we've been trying to see it, and take this limit, you find out that essentially this theory happens to be because the field, the gravitational, quote-unquote, the frozen gravitational field is described by topological field theory. You have a particle, but essentially what you can find is that this theory is actually equivalent to Chern-Simons theory on the boundary of space-time with punctures associated with each particle. Each puncture, okay, associated with a particle actually carries the information of the particle's momentum and spin. Okay? But then, what is the effective action that we find is the following. You have a tree on the boundary of space-time, which I assume has a topology of S2 with n puncture with real time. I have a Chern-Simons theory. This is Hamiltonian form of Chern-Simons theory. And this is the Hamiltonian form of particle action. And this is, okay, this is along the boundary component of the gauge field along the boundary. The gauge group is still SO41. And the curvature is subject with the constraints, which essentially says, as in 2 plus 1 gravity, that the curvature is essentially non-zero only where at the position where the particle is. And D is essentially describes what is the spin and the momentum of the particle. So what is the charge that particle actually carries? Okay? And then if you know a little bit about 2 plus 1 gravity, you see that this is exactly the same theory as 2 plus 1 gravity, with the only difference that in the case of 2 plus 1 gravity, the gauge group is, in Lorentzian case, is either three-dimensional Poincaré or SU, or three-dimensional, or SO31 or SO22, depending on the sign of the cosmological constant. That means that essentially all the methods of 2 plus 1 gravity can be applied here. Okay? It's, okay, this is a sphere, well, the theory is topological, okay? So essentially I can deform the surface the any way I want, but topologically it's two-dimensional sphere, okay, at infinity, very far away. So I have some charges here inside my original space-time, and I take a big sphere outside it, and what I can argue, well, perhaps not completely honestly show, is that the theory, this initial theory I started with, becomes so let me draw it perhaps. Okay, this is space, no space-time, I have my particles. I draw a big sphere around the particles, and I claim that the theory that I started with in this topological limit, of course, so all the degrees of freedom of gravity are switched off, is equivalent to the Chern-Simons, there is a time, of course, direction flowing up. Well, this is another direction. And not in the picture, yeah. Okay, so let me draw it like this. This is another direction. And essentially, the theory that I started with is equivalent to the Chern-Simons theory on the space-time, or on the 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time, where the space of this Chern-Simons theory is just a two-sphere, the time is time, and to each particle there is a corresponding puncture on the sphere.
essentially, the reason is, okay, the way to understand it is the following, that if you try to solve the classical equation of motion of this theory, okay, so I start with 3 plus 1 and solve the classical equation of motion, you find out that particle is essentially, to each particle there is essentially a string attached, something like Taub-Nut string. And then if you start thinking about the effective Lagrangian, okay, the Lagrangian that describes the kinematics of this theory, it is this, but essentially the reason is that each particle there is, for each particle there is a string which actually goes from particle to infinity, which pierces the surface. Okay, that's not completely, I think it's not completely, it's, okay, so this is one of the loopholes of this whole scheme, but essentially this is the picture which is behind it. Well, it's quite, the physical origin of this string is essentially the same as the physical origin of the monopole string. Okay, if you start looking at the equation of motion, it turns out that you cannot solve the equation of motion for non-singular connections. No, not really. Okay, there is a flat. There is. It is. Okay. I will show it if you want. I will show it into one. Essentially, the point is that if you start looking at the equation of motion, you find out that there is no solution of equation of motion for non-singular connection, but there is a solution if you add this kind of a Dirac string term to the connection, and then you may argue essentially that the solution corresponds to Taub-Nut space with the non-trivial Taub-Nut mass, but with zero Schwarzschild mass. Okay. But if you want, I can show you some details later on. So anyway, physically, it's just a bunch of free particles. Okay.
Even bundles that introduce.
Mm-hmm. At this moment, this is just a bunch of free particles. And if you look at this action, you'll find that this term in the action is essentially describing a bunch of free particles. And this describes the coupling of the particles to the gravitational field. Mm-hmm. Good. Now, so what's happened? Well, as I said, this is a system which is very similar to the standard, to the system that people busy with 2 plus 1 gravity are actually investigating. And essentially, the essential result of this investigation is the following. And this result does not really much depend much on the particular gauge group you're actually having. So what can be shown for the system? The phase space is actually finite dimensional. And the phase space can be described, so there is a system of gravity plus particle, but the phase space actually happens to be, because of the huge symmetry that topological Chern-Simon theory has, it can be described in terms of n group elements. So for each particle, okay, so the phase space is fully described by a group element attached to each particle. For each particle, I have a group element that describes fully the phase space of the system. Well, the Poisson brackets on the phase space is defined with the help of something which is called R matrix, which is, well, it's not a surprise, because R matrix essentially is a device that makes it possible to construct a Poisson structure on group manifold. Okay? And then the claim is that, in fact, what we're going to expect is that the symmetry group should be, instead of being initially this SO41, should be quantum deformed SO41, and I'm not going to go much into details, except for the particular model I'm going to show in a moment. Okay? This is something about our matrix. Let me just skip it. The important thing is that having the R matrix, there is an R matrix associated with any group,
and you can compute it, and then you can associate with having the R matrix, you can associate, you can find something which is called bivector, which makes it possible for you to calculate the Poisson bracket. And the Poisson bracket that you calculate from purely group theory, or called algebra theory, is the following. In the limit in which cosmological constant goes to zero, the so you take the contraction, essentially. When I say cosmological constant goes to zero, I mean the contraction of the original SO4-1 group to down to Poincaré group. And then you find that this group theoretical Poisson structure is given by this. Well, the group theory, okay, from group theory, you know that there are four translational elements, which I denote Q, and six elements which are essentially dual to Lorentz transformation, which is called S. I mean S because of spins, right? And Q would denote the positions. Okay, so there are spins. They have quite funny algebra. This algebra is called a Kappa Poincaré group in the Hopf algebra terminology. And here I will concentrate on this part. This part, for anybody who knows a little bit about Kappa star, this is nothing but the Kappa Minkowski space. This is Poisson bracket of Kappa Minkowski space. And now let me do the following. Let me actually, yes.
What determines the value of kappa?
The kappa is actually, okay, the kappa is related. Kappa is determined. Kappa is determined by the original coupling constant of the Chern-Simon theory, which if the whole procedure goes through, it might be related to the original gravitational constant. So kappa is essentially could be understood as a square root of as a Planck mass. Okay, if you associate it with the gravitational constant of the original theory. But this is kind of tricky, so this limiting procedure and this construction is kind of tricky. So let me just say that this kappa is actually related to the coupling constant of the original Chern-Simon theory. So I have a three-dimensional case, I have Chern-Simon coupling, and this kappa is related to the Chern-Simon coupling. Okay? So let me actually tell you what a model based on this. Let me actually give you a model of W special relativity. Okay, this kappa is essentially of a dimension. It has a dimension of mass. Okay, if you scale appropriately the Poisson bracket, so this is a dimensional constant. And essentially see that in this way, you actually associate this second scale of W special relativity with this parameter kappa, which shows up in the Poisson bracket of the theory. So let me now tell you how to construct a theory, because that's what I did. I found the sub-Poisson brackets, but what I did was pure algebra. The question is, could I find a particle model which actually features the same kind of Poisson bracket? And indeed I can. The idea is the following. I'm essentially taking a group element, an element which belongs to the original gauge group, which I call P, with some particular SO4-1 generators which satisfy this particular commutation relation. And the kappa is actually a scale which is bidimensional, has dimensional mass. So I take this group element,
And then I find, and then I construct the action, which is a standard action on the group. Okay, if you have a group, you can also, there is a, essentially standard, the standard Lagrangian you can construct for the group. I guess this is actually the Kirillov, this guy is nothing but the, something which is called Kirillov symplectic form. So essentially I have a group element, so I can take a, I can get an algebra element from this in this way. This is the time parameter, so the some evolution parameter. I take the Q, which is the element of the algebra, and then if I do the calculation, this is some particular dispersion relation which has this form, and this form is associated with the this particular parameterization that I was using before, and this is essentially the action that I, this is essentially action that I end up with. We'll see that contrary to the action, to the special relativistic action, which just has this kinetic term, this action actually contains additional deformation term. I mean, the term that governs the deformation. Yes. Yes, I do, but lambda is again, it's a Lagrange multiplier, so you can, it's like how you call it, N in general relativity. I mean, the lambda, you can see that the lambda actually, there is additional gauge freedom here associated with the reparametrization of the tau. And by this gauge freedom, you can always fix lambda equal 1. Okay? There is a gauge freedom associated, like in general relativistic, in any relativistic particle model, the tau, if there is a gauge freedom associated with tau, you can reparameterize tau. Okay? And the gauge field for this reparameterization is essentially lambda, so you can actually gauge fix it to, be equal 1. Okay? So this is a theory. And this is a model, this is actually a particle model of DSR. In fact, it contains a scale as we wanted. It's non-trivial model, okay, because it's a deformation. It's very similar in spirit to the particle models, effective particle models that people has obtained for in the case of 2 plus 1 gravity. If you look at the equation of motion, the particle is free, as it should. And you can check the infinitesimal symmetries, and the infinitesimal symmetries form something called Kappa-Poincaré algebra. That's some non-trivial. So there are Lorentz transformations, and there are rotations, and there are translations, and the algebra of them is non-trivially deformed compared to the Poincaré, the standard Poincaré algebra. What you can also show is that if you calculate the speed of a particle, okay, let me show you again. This Lagrangian is not a Lagrangian of the standard relativistic particle. First, it contains this term, and also it contains a deformed dispersion relation. But, surprisingly, it turns out that the speed of massless particles, okay, naively computed according to this formula, turns out to be 1. Okay, I compute this by Hamiltonian method, and it turns out to be exactly 1. So there is no energy-dependent speed of light in this theory. All right, I have to speed up. Okay, so let me make a major point. Now, let us try to see, and let us try to think if this theory is physically feasible. And in order to see, to judge. And now let me try to go back to apology. I formulated a model that I didn't have much time to argue, but this is a nice particle model of which features all the properties that we like about DSR. So this is a DSR, so to say, particle model. Question is this particle model consistent? Is it physically acceptable? And to see it, let us try to see what are the transformations. So these are the invariances of the model. As you see, this is kind of complex. So for the rotations are simple, but the boosts are already quite complex. And also, the translations are modified with respect to the standard case. In particular, if I take a translation, space translation, then the time coordinates is getting changed, and it's getting changed by the amount which is proportional to the momentum that particle carries. Okay, and this is quite important because it immediately poses a problem, which was pointed out by Sabine a few months ago. And in this setting is essentially the following problem. Suppose I have two word lines of two particles. Okay, so I'm an observer here. I'm looking at two particles. And suppose for me, these two particles, the word lines of these two particles cross. Okay? Now, suppose Lee actually looks at the same particles. Lee is an observer which is translated with respect to me. Does he see these two particles word line cross? Well, he doesn't. He doesn't because the translation, the action of translation on particle depends on momentum it carries. So if the particles that we were considering were the particles carrying different momentum, the translation would be different for them. Okay? And this is a disturbing problem. Okay? Let me show you the drawing. This is Alice. The Alice sees the word lines meet. And the Bob, who is translated, actually sees that the word lines actually miss each other. And in my view, this is an important conceptual problem. Not really phenomenological, because you can argue that phenomenologically this effect is extremely small. For example, this, for the distance of 1 billion light year, the shift in time between the word lines will be 10 to minus 3 seconds for essentially 1 GeV photon. However, the problem is conceptual, because essentially the way we construct we think of special relativity, and this is supposed to be a theory of the same sort, is we construct operatively. We construct special relativity just thinking about word lines that cross. Okay? Observer is a word line. Light signal is a word line. A mirror is a word line. I have light signal that actually hits the mirror and scatters back the word lines meet. And it's obvious, it's an obvious assumption that the fact that the word lines meet is actually objective. I mean, all the observers actually agree about it. And he...
I don't know
exactly what doesn't happen.
Why? Nobody knows
what happens.
Well, of course, in quantum gravity, you would think that something is getting blurred, right? Somehow. Right? But now I'm thinking in terms of completely classical model. Okay? This model can be quantized, of course, and if you quantize the model, you will have a quantum effect. But on the level of purely classical model, this seems at least odd. Okay, this effect seems at least odd. And actually, of course, if you quantize this, okay, I would expect that the effect goes away. I would expect that the effect goes magnified, right?
But if I thought that DSR somehow captures some Planckian physics, then maybe it should pick up some effect. I don't know. I'm not arguing for it, but I'm...
Well, I don't know.
I'm not sure how am I supposed to think of DSR in that context. You're saying I should still...
I mean, in this context is a purely classical context, okay? And, of course, on top of this, you expect quantum effects, right? But you don't really expect... I mean, if you want to stay in the limit of DSR, because you don't really think of this very strong quantum gravitational effect, because... DSR actually is supposed to work where the local effects of gravity actually switched off.
Okay.
But isn't in the 2 plus 1 case, don't they also let G go to 0 and as a result they get this non-commutative theory?
Yeah.
So doesn't that sound a bit similar to...
So this will be a part of my apology. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me try to conclude. Is it any comments right now? Just to
support Fortini's argument. I mean, this, I would claim this is a quantum gravity effect, and that G and H bar are in the kappa, which in fact they are, especially if you derive them through a root of quantum gravity. So there is a G and there is an H bar. But I mean, this is the beginning of an argument. Not a resolution. I'm not surprised that there's a paradox at the classical level that if you kept the rest of quantum mechanics in, you might be able to resolve. Whether the rest of quantum mechanics is sufficient to resolve it is a discussion which is not, you know, which is another discussion.
Well, my point, the point I would like to stress is that the construction of the theory is purely classical. Okay? I'm talking purely classical theory.
Yeah.
Okay. Although, of course, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
The question is, if this is not a quantum gravity effect, what is it? Why do you have kappa there in the first place?
Kappa is a trace of Newton's constant.
But it has an H bar in it, because it's you have it as a
yeah,
H bar G. It's the square of H bar G.
All right. Well, okay. Even if I say that this is a semi-classical limit of gravity, okay, of quantum gravity somehow, then I think that the situation is still okay. So in my view, it is still disturbing. Okay. So I'm taking the semi-classical limit. Okay, and then I have this problem with the world marks. I would expect that they switch. Okay, if I switch on the quantum gravity effect, okay, the problem was going. I would expect the problem would go worse, not better. And also, if it is to be a fundamental theory, then these variables that I use lose their operative meaning. I mean, even if I buy this, then it's a quantum gravity.
If we start arguing about this now, then we'll
all right. Okay, so let me go to conclusions essentially.
So what she's saying is that there's an observer dependent effect.
Mm-hmm.
And this means you violated special relativity. You can't have observer dependent unless you violate Lorentz invariance.
No, it doesn't have nothing to do with Lorentz invariance. I mean, Lorentz invariance is there. The problem is not that the theory doesn't possess Lorentz invariance, because it does. The problem is that the Lorentz invariance acts in a kind of funny way. And it acts differently depending on what the momentum of the particle is. So for each particle, there is a perfect Lorentz invariance. However, if you start with particles of different momenta, the Lorentz transformation would essentially be different.
Well, so it is a violation of Lorentz invariance.
No, it is. Well, what it depends what. Yes. No, it is not the violation. Okay, it depends what you call Lorentz invariance. Lorentz invariance in the group theoretical setting is that you have a group of transformation which is a Lorentz group. And here I have the same thing.
No, but you bring in two momenta, you violate that symmetry.
I wouldn't say it so strongly. I wouldn't. It's a semantic discussion, essentially. I mean, I believe that it's clear what's happening.
Is it fair? Yeah. So, if it is clear, then is the following what's clear, that the Lorentz group is not acting on space time as we ordinarily think of it.
Let me jump to the conclusion, because this is essentially the message I want to make. There is an issue of many particles, and the hope was that if you switch many particles, because you have two word lines, so in fact what you have to do is describe, this is two particle system, right? So you need to have a common description of two particle system, and the hope was that it helped, but it doesn't. Okay, so this is to you, Lee. It doesn't help. I mean, switching concord product.
No, you're rushing. Go back.
I want to jump into conclusion. Okay. So if you okay, so just the only thing that I want to say is that because I was considering two word lines, okay, to be honest, I had to consider two particle Lagrangian, not two one particle Lagrangian, because they as in 2 plus 1 gravity, these particles essentially talk to each other. They are not independent. But it doesn't, and the hope was that perhaps this helps solve this, solving this problem, but it doesn't. It doesn't make the problem worse, but it doesn't make it any, better looking. Okay, now, so I'm jumping to the conclusion. My view is that this problem is completely devastating. For the reason that, as it stands, it's completely devastating because we now, we use word line actually to define what the spacetime is. Okay, so if there is no, if the crossing of word line is not observing the patterns of thing, then of course you cannot even define the spacetime. So now, what are the ways out? Well, the ways out are the following. I think the most promising ways out is the following. Well, you should notice that P and Q, what they are. Well, there are some parameters that there is, they form a parameterization of the phase space of the system. There is nothing which tells you that I need to associate Q with space-time measurements. Right? I can parameterize. This is some parameter, some convenient parameterization of phase space of a particle, but it doesn't tell you that Q actually is related to space-time measurements. Okay? The question is, can you define the variables that behave properly under Lorentz transformation so that indeed the crossing of word lines is preserved? And the answer is in generally not. But the answer is also that this I can find a parameterization of phase space in which I have variables which decently behave under Lorentz, and I have a different parameterization of phase space in which I have variables which decently behave under translation, but not both. So I cannot have a full Poincaré group at the same time, but I can have a formulation in which the Lorentz group, so the Lorentz transformation acts in the acceptable way. But then, of course, one comment is that the statement, I started with a statement about the speed of light, okay? But in order to calculate the speed of light, I use these variables, Q. But if I argue that these variables are not physical, this is just a particular representation of a phase space, the statement about speed of light is meaningless. And in the same sense, I think the statement that actually Sabine was making about speed of light is completely meaningless as well. Well, you need to have well-behaving coordinates in space-time to say what velocity is. Okay? Now, I was considering only two particles, but of course the universe consists of lots of particles, and if you believe in this kind of deformed model, all of these particles talk to each other. There is some kind of a topological interaction between them. So they are still free, but they still know about each other's existence, contrary to standard special relativity. So perhaps if you go to the limit of big number of particles, perhaps the problem is going to be resolved. I don't know. Okay, then even if kinematics of particles doesn't seem to suffer from some problems, the field theory seems to be completely healthy. And the nice thing about field theory is that the field theory, of, especially quantum field theory, essentially knows about only half of the phase space. You can equivalent, for example, you can formulate the field theory on momentum space completely without even knowing anything about space-time, or vice versa. You can formulate the field theory on space-time without even knowing anything about the momentum space. So the field theory seems to be, and quantum field theory seems to be reasonably healthy, although we have a problem of including interaction to the field theory. And the summary is the following. In my view, the accusations and the charges against DSR are quiet, severe, and I think that the current verdict is that it's guilty. I mean, at this moment, I couldn't see of any example of four-dimensional DSR theory that would not suffer of this problem. However, in 2 plus 1 gravity, so this is a light in a tunnel,
in 2 plus 1 gravity that we believe is completely Horner's theory, there is essentially the same problem. So perhaps if you understand the, if you understand this issue of weird lines in 2 plus 1 gravity, perhaps it would teach us a lesson concerning the 3 plus 1 case. And, well, there was an important lesson here that the mathematical consistency is not really enough. It's not sufficient because the model I was presenting is completely mathematically consistent. But of course, we must think about physics and try to understand physics. And unfortunately, our present understanding is that what we see in these models, what we see as the properties of these models, seems to contradict our understanding of physics. And I'm sorry for extending the time, but this is, I think, everything I have to say. Thank you.